Hello and welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today was born in Calcutta and grew up in Dhaka, Kathmandu and Delhi. She's a journalist who's now based in London and combines her reporting with her love of history. Her four books have evolved from her observations about the shared past of India and Britain. Her 2010 work, Victoria and Abdul, is now a major motion picture starring Judi Dench. Shrabani, welcome to Meet the Writers.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
Now, tell me about your early life, because you, as the daughter of a diplomat, must have moved around a lot. Where were you born?
I was born in Calcutta, in India. But when I was a year old, my dad got posted. So we went to Dhaka, which was then East Pakistan. I also went to Kathmandu. So a lot of South Asian countries.
Mm-hmm. You went to college in Delhi.
That's right. A lot of my life was, the last years were in Delhi. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Studying history, and as we know from your books, of course, that's been tremendously useful. Mm-hmm. You then went on, though, to be a trainee journalist. Now, tell me about that.
Well, it was quite amusing because I just applied because a friend said, they'll take us to Bombay. We were both in Delhi. Shall we apply and have a holiday in Bombay? And I said, yes. So we, students, we'd get the train tickets and we went off to Bombay for a week in Bombay. And then I got the job and I was still doing my master's at the time. Master's in Delhi is 2 years and I was in my second year. So then I said, okay, I might take this because I've always wanted to be a journalist. So I took the job, then I came back and finished my master's. It was all very fast and furious, but I had 6 months in Bombay, and that was the starting of my journalistic career. It was amazing.
And what sort of things did you tend to focus on as a journalist?
Well, I was in the Times of India, so in the training scheme as an apprentice, you're put through everything. And those are the days of block print, lead print. I'm showing my age now. But it was fabulous. We were sent through the magazines, because Times of India is the biggest media group there. They have magazines, newspapers, evening newspapers. We were put through the mill for everything. It was solid training, including sitting in the print room and looking at the lead blocks.
Such good experience for what you then went on to do. Were you thinking about writing books at that point?
Oh, no, no. It was no way. I just wanted to do a good story. As all journalists do, you look for those stories. All I wanted was a scoop and a good byline.
And what stands out for you then in terms of scoops or indeed interviewees? I know you've interviewed some amazing people.
And that was later, of course. I mean, as a trainee, I was just doing all sorts of stories. But I did get a few exclusives. The big interviews came later. That's when I came to London and I joined the ABP Group, which is a newspaper based in Calcutta. And I worked for the Sunday magazine. My first story was actually Salman Rushdie. He had just written Satanic Verses, and I had a tip-off from my office that this is going to cause some controversy. So I asked for an interview, and I was all of, 25 at that time, and I was in awe of Salman Rushdie because I loved his books. So I interviewed him, and I asked him if a book could cause riots, and he said, a book can never cause riots. And that interview, it was a long interview, it was a fabulous interview. And that interview got picked up by these politicians in Delhi, waved around in Parliament, that particular sentence, and they banned the book. They banned the book in India. And that was horrible for me because I felt, oh my God, this is not my fault, but this has happened because of my interview. Mm. So I rang him. Those are the days without mobile phones and he was on a promotion tour. I rang every hotel in Edinburgh to find out where he was staying and I got through. And I said, look, I'm really sorry, but this, he said, no, it's not your fault. Don't worry. So that then developed so quickly because as soon as India banned it, Pakistan banned it. And then in Iran, Khomeini said, oh, goodness, if all these people are banning it, I've got to go one step further. And then it was the fatwa. And then it got really, really dangerous. And overnight he was in hiding. But he did keep in touch with me. And the first interview he gave after he came out of hiding was to me.
Oh, amazing. And you're forgiven, presumably.
Oh, yeah, yeah. He never blamed me.
Many other huge, huge names. So, for instance, Benazir Bhutto.
When she was not prime minister, she was just waiting. And that was a fabulous interview, too. I always find it fascinating to interview women politicians because of the struggle and the journey they've made. There was also Sheikh Hasina. She was also out of power. So now I'm always doing these interviews when they're out of power. But she was doing her laundry. So as the washing machine is, spinning, we were talking politics. It was amazing. And she didn't know how to load this machine, but it was good.
So you moved to London, you were doing these big interviews. And at some level, it must have been percolating that you were going to write a book. And indeed, your first book was curry. Tell me how that came about.
Well, that was a very journalistic piece, actually, because the moment I landed here, I was amazed to find that every high street in Britain had a curry house, an Indian restaurant. And that's when I realized that they were called curry houses, because in India, we don't say curry. We go out for a North Indian meal or a South Indian meal. There's no concept of curry. And everyone would ask me if I could cook curries. And I said, what's this craze for Indian food? Then, of course, I realized that it wasn't Indian food at all that was being served in the restaurants. And they were not cooked by Indians. They were cooked by Bangladeshis. So the whole thing was quite amusing. And I did a few articles. And then a publisher asked me to write a book. I said, why don't you just put this all down in a book? And that's how it started, really.
And there's quite a famous disclaimer at the front of one of the editions, I believe.
Yes. Do not try the recipes, because I had some 19th century recipes. And I would not recommend those.
But that was the start, really, of your literary career. Did you carry on with your journalism after that came out?
Oh, yes. I'm still a journalist. That's a day job. I love it. I really like the daily news. It keeps you grounded. And it's also led me to so many stories, actually. I have like a filing cabinet of things that interest me, and then I just put them away. Mm. Some of my books have emerged out of my journalism.
Well, let's talk about your next book, Spy Princess. Now, this is about Noor Inayat Khan. Who was she?
Well, she was a secret agent in the Second World War. She was of Indian origin. Her father was Indian. Her mother was American. She was brought up in Paris, and she moved to England when war broke out. She volunteered for the Women's Auxiliary Air Force. But very quickly, because she knew French and because she was a good radio operator, they recruited her into this organization called the SOE, Special Operations Executive. And it was a secret organization started directly by Churchill to help the resistance fighters in the occupied countries. So she became the first woman radio operator to be sent into occupied France. And she worked out of Paris, which was the most dangerous area because the Gestapo were everywhere. There were informers everywhere. And as a radio operator, she had the most dangerous job in the field because as she went out transmitting, she could be detected. Mm. And so they were losing radio operators at the rate of 2 a day. And their life expectancy was 6 weeks. But Noor Inayat Khan lasted 3 months. She would have lived to tell her tale, but she was betrayed. She was captured and she was sent to Dachau concentration camp where she was executed.
It's a really sad story of an incredibly brave woman. Now, this led you actually to set up a trust in her name.
Yes, she was awarded the George Cross for her bravery because she did not, despite all the torture, did not give away any names. And also she did a tremendous job when she was in the field. So her story was forgotten. I said there were only 3 women in Britain who ever got the George Cross, and she was one of them. We know about the other 2, Odette Hallows and Violette Szabo, but we know nothing about Noor Inayat Khan. So I just felt that her story should be told, because at the end of the day, it wasn't even her war. She was Indian. She actually believed in Indian independence. So there was a lot going on there. And yet she felt that this fight against fascism had to be fought, and that was the priority. So this young woman sacrificed her life in the fight against fascism. And I just felt her story had to be known far more than just the book. And I got a lot of letters from readers, actually, who said there should be a memorial for her. So it was actually their idea, not mine. So I said, oh, that would be nice. And why not a blue plaque? Because a lot of the other SOE agents have blue plaques. And then, funnily enough, that was rejected. And, you know, there is nothing like a rejection to really get you going. So that really got me very angry. And I said, how could she be rejected? There were so many letters. There was a man who wrote to me saying, I will write every day to the Prime Minister asking for a memorial. So I said, everyone's feeling very passionately about this. We've got to do something. So then we campaigned for a memorial for her, set up a trust, cobbled everybody, campaigned with the MPs, peers, businessmen for the money, everybody we could get hold of. And in 2 years, we raised money for the memorial, we got the permission, and Princess Anne unveiled it.
Where is it?
It's in Gordon Square in London, very close to the house she lived in. The good thing is that now we put in a second application for her blue plaque, because it's very close to the house where the blue plaque was rejected. And we are hoping, she's been shortlisted, so we hope it'll go through this time.
Oh, you'd imagine so, wouldn't you? And woe betide anybody who gets in your way, I think. Now, of course, the book that everybody knows you for is the one that you wrote immediately after that, and that's Victoria and Abdul. Where did that come from? Where did the germ of that idea start?
It actually started with the curry, as probably all good things do. Well, while I was researching the book, I knew that Queen Victoria loved her curries and that she had some Indian servants. And that was basically what I knew. But it was on a trip to Osborne House on the Isle of Wight, which is Queen Victoria's holiday resort. And there was this Indian room and an Indian corridor. And in this corridor, there was a portrait of Abdul Karim. And he was painted in red and gold, and he was holding a book. And I said, he doesn't look like a servant. He's been painted to look like a nobleman. He's holding a book. And then I walked down and there was another portrait and he was looking directly at me. This was a beautiful portrait by Von Angeli. And then I found busts and I found various other photographs. And then the clincher was Queen Victoria's bedroom, where in the dressing area, there were two photographs near her dressing table. And one of them was of John Brown, with whom she'd had a relationship after Albert died. And just below John Brown was the photograph of Abdul Karim. And that clinched it for me. I said, this man is special. I need to know more about him.
And so you did fantastic research. I mean, he taught her to speak Urdu, didn't he?
That's right. I mean, nobody knows that Queen Victoria learnt Urdu for the last 13 years of her life and was actually fluent in reading and writing. She could write half a page of Urdu, which is a pretty difficult language to learn, especially at her age. There were so many details that nobody knew. Mm. And I didn't know either. I was just discovering them as I went. So it was a fascinating journey for me as well, process of discovery.
Because she kept journals written in Urdu. And I think, were you the first person to read them?
Oh, yes, I was. I think all Western biographers had ignored these journals. They're lying in Windsor Castle. And I asked to see these because I knew that she'd learned some Urdu. And I expected one exercise book with a few phrases. But the archivist walked in with a trolley and there were 13 volumes there. 13, one for each year that she'd spent with Abdul. Well, I said, I'm going to be here a long time. Those journals just told me how close their relationship was. It was just the little personal details, things like, I'm going to go to the Munshi's house because his cat has had kittens. And this is the Empress of India. You know, it showed the intimacy that they shared. Then, of course, I went on. I found Abdul's grave. And finally, at the end of 4 years, I discovered his journals. And these were in Karachi with his family.
And you found his family too.
I found his family. That or rather, they found me.
Yeah, tell us about that, because that's an interesting story.
It was, because I kept searching for the family, obviously. And I found his grave and I'd found his old house. But when I found the old house, they said that after partition, the family had moved to Pakistan. So the trail had gone cold. I knew he didn't have any children. I had no names to go by. I was just searching. So I decided I had enough material to bring out the hardback, which I did. And I knew it in my bones that somebody's going to reach out as soon as this is published. And within days, they did. I was in Bangalore in South India, and I was called by the British Council. And they said, there's a man here who says he's the great-grandson of Abdul Karim. I just laughed and I said, yeah, and I'm Winston Churchill. And that was just a sort of knee-jerk reaction. And they said, no, he's serious. He says he's got proof. So I said, okay, let him come and meet me. So this man came. I was doing a talk at the Bangalore Club and he came with a briefcase and he showed me lots of photographs. But as a journalist, you have to further, you know, vet your sources. Anyone can have photographs. Mm-hmm. I said, this is not enough. How do we prove this? So he said, my mother's alive. And she is 87. Come and meet her. So I did. The mother was the daughter of his nephew. So it was a direct link. And I mentioned the nephew in my book. So when I met her and I saw the house and she talked about Agra, it all just fell in place. And they told me that their family in Karachi, in Pakistan, had a diary. The next thing, I got my visa and I was off to Pakistan.
Well, the book, of course, phenomenally successful and then picked up as a film. Now, I interviewed Stephen Frears a little while ago, who directed the film, and he tells me that normally he chooses his projects because he reads something and just is absolutely gripped by the story. Mm-hmm. Is that what happened?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, initially it was opted by Working Title and Lee Hall was the screenplay writer. And then they took it, Working Title took it to Stephen Frears. And, well, he has done Asian themes before. He did My Beautiful Laundrette and he's done The Queen. So, you know, it was a combination of both the royal theme and an Asian theme. So he was the perfect director for this. And I'm so glad he accepted it at once. Mm. He loved the story. One thing led to another, and soon Judi Dench was on board, and there was Universal Studios backing it, so yeah, it was good.
And you worked with the screenwriter. You didn't write the screenplay yourself.
No. I wouldn't even know how to. That's, I think, a different set of skills. And also, you're too close to the subject, so I wouldn't even attempt it. Mm. In fact, I chose, because there were so many studios bidding for it as soon as the book was published, at least 6 or 7 studios, but I chose Lee Hall, and I chose Working Title, because they made a joint bid. And I like Lee Hall's work. He did Billy Elliot. He did War Horse. He's written books about people from the wrong side of the tracks. And I felt Abdul would be safe in his hands. So I went with him. We had lots of meetings. His wife was a producer as well, Beban Kidron. She was excellent. And we discussed his character. And then when Stephen came on board, we had further meetings with Stephen. Talked about how we flesh out Abdul Karim. I was a consultant also on things like costumes, art design. What did Indian men, Muslim men wear in the 19th century? I went into the archives of the British Library. Everything was reproduced from really authentic photographs. Mm. Prisoners in Agra jail. Those are all the costumes they wore.
And of course, you just got an Oscar nomination for that.
Yes. Yeah. I'm really chuffed that it actually was in costumes because I played a role in that.
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, you hand carried fabric back from India, didn't you?
I did. And buttons. I mean, every button that Abdul wears, gold buttons on his fabulous costumes, were hand stitched in India. On my trips, I just carry some of them back.
Yeah. Of course, Judi Dench played Queen Victoria in the film. What was that experience like, working with this grand dame of acting?
Oh, I remember the day I was told Judi had accepted. I was jumping up and down. I was so delighted. I mean, she was the perfect person for this role, of course. Our first meeting, I was so nervous because this is Dame Judi Dench. And of course, she is so lovely. I think all great people are. They're just so down to earth. And she said, I said, thank you for accepting this role. And she said, thank you for writing the book. And, you know, she's just so lovely. She's full of fun and down to earth. And what an actress. There is this scene she does in which she eats a boiled egg in the morning. And she went through 11 eggs for that scene. So she is just a perfectionist.
That's amazing. Yeah, real method actress there.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she'd get dressed. I mean, she's 83 now, but at that time she was 82. And so to all that hair and makeup every day sitting in the trailer, so professional.
We talked about your Oscar nomination for costume, but of course you also got another nomination.
And that was hair and makeup. All part of the whole thing. And Abdul's gear, also Judi Dench. I mean, there were so many layers that went into her. The hair, the face, everything. I mean, it was amazing. And the director of photography, he said that she is so good. There's one scene where she talks about, I am not insane, you know, that famous scene. And he said the camera is just 2 feet from her. And he said, you put a camera 2 feet from somebody and you're doing such an intense close-up and you're putting a camera on an 82-year-old, that's something. But she just went with it. She was absolutely fine.
You've been doing a lot of panel discussions on book to screen. And I wonder how that worked for you. As we discussed, you work closely with the screenwriter. Does it have to change substantially? And is it a feeling of sort of letting go of your baby, I suppose?
I think you have to. If you're too possessive about it, it won't work. A director said, cut the umbilical cord, don't think about it. So while that is difficult, I was very lucky because my book was in safe hands. I didn't feel I was in conflict about any of the stuff. And I did want it to be made in a popular way. I did want it to reach the audience. I mean, the book deals with all the racism, but you don't want long lectures on racism. And it has to all be put in a subtle way and it has to be fun. This is a film. This is 2 hours of a captive audience. It's not the book and it has to have a life of its own. So I was really pleased with the way he does it. Lee Hall is fantastically funny. He's got such great one-liners. I liked what he did with Baksha's character because some of it is fictionalized, which is fine. And he played up the two. So there was a good balance between the two. I think it worked well.
So he comes out in the end. I mean, we gather that actually, possibly he wasn't a very nice man.
There's all shades of grey. It went to his head. When he went initially, he was just 24. He didn't ask to be sent. That's the way I see it. He was sent there. He actually wanted to go back. He said, I've never done menial work. He was quite proud. And I want to go back. But the Queen begs him to stay. This is a letter I found in his journal that she says, please, I want to learn Urdu from you. I enjoy your company. This is the Queen of England. And this is a 24-year-old commoner from India. What choice does he have? Of course he stays on. And then she lavishes presents on him. She gives him titles, she gives him land, gives him houses. it does go to his head. I mean, it's a bit of a teenage rock star. He enjoys the attention he gets. But I don't think he's a rogue. I don't think he's manipulative. What we do know later is that he gets gonorrhea. And that is a bit of a mystery. But I have a timeline for, I think, when he got it. And I think he got it in India.
So interesting. And it's been absolutely huge. Were you surprised by that? I mean, the film has swept the world. And obviously that must have driven up sales of the book too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the good thing. I mean, a book gets a second lease of life. It went on the Sunday Times bestseller list. It's doing very well in the US as well. So that's great for writers. But when I was writing it, there was nothing. It was 4 years of very hard research and, you know, moments of sheer frustration because the letters had been burned and I was like, how do I get the material for this book? What am I doing here? But it all worked out at the end, so I'm glad I persisted.
Mm. Well, of course, even before the film came out, you were working on another book. So tell us about your most recent book.
That is something that I find very dear to my heart, and I felt I had to write that book. It's about Indians in the First World War.
For King and Another Country.
That's right.
Yeah.
And it's Indians on the Western Front. And I felt that the centenary was coming up, 2014 to 2018, we will be observing and remembering the dead. And I felt that the Indian story had just been completely ignored. 1.5 million Indians came and fought in these foreign fields. For the first time, it was their first Western war. I mean, it was terrible for the Brits. Can you imagine what it was like for the Indians? They came in their cotton khaki drill. They didn't have greatcoats till December. I read the letters they wrote back home. They are just so emotional. They really break your heart. But they carried on. They fought. They won gallantry awards. And none of these people are known. They were peasants, illiterate peasants who came from villages in India. They're only remembered in their little villages back home. I traced the story. I went back to those villages, talked to the families. And I'm not a military historian. For me, it's the personal stories. So I followed the lives of some soldiers.
And there are wonderful sort of vignettes in there about lives of these people. Give us an example.
Well, I'll tell you about Gabbar Singh Negi. He was 22 years old. He came to the Western Front. He was awarded the Victoria Cross, but he died. So it's a posthumous award. But when I went to his village in Garhwal, in the hills in north of Delhi, and his family told me that his wife was 14 years old when he died, and she was a child bride, and she never remarried. She was illiterate. She didn't even know, she couldn't read all the citations, but she wore his Victoria Cross pinned on her sari all her life. You know, she would gather firewood, walk in the forest, and all the villagers would stand up and salute her.
That's amazing.
I just found that such a lovely story. And I have found a photograph of hers when she's 80. She lived to a good old age and she's taking the salute because every year there would be a memorial. And it still is. There is a memorial, a day when they celebrate his birth. And there is a parade and it's all with military honours. And she used to take the salute. This tiny little wizened old lady wearing the Victoria Cross. For me, those stories were very special. Those they left behind. I also looked at stories of the Maharajas, the flamboyant ones. I didn't know that India had actually signed on the Treaty of Versailles. That was something I realized. There were pilots. I had no idea that we had Indian pilots in the First World War. One of them was just 19 years old. He was the first, India's first flying ace. He took down 10 German aircraft and went down. He died. But as his plane went down, he took down 2 more German aircraft. He was called Laddie. And he was just a flamboyant teenager. So all these stories, I felt they all had to be told.
And of course, they feed into the wider history because of it's how the war utterly changed India and led ultimately to the call for independence.
Of course. I mean, this is what I deal with as well, that 5 months after the war, they supported this war, hoping that they would get home rule, just like the other Commonwealth countries had got. But instead, they got a slap on the face. They got 5 months after the end of the war, Herculean laws were implemented and there was a protest in Amritsar against this. And everybody knows the Jallianwala Bagh incident. There was a protest meeting in Jallianwala Bagh. General Dyer entered there and it was an enclosed space and he fired till the last bullet was finished. And men, women and children were killed. And this is on the holiest day of the Sikhs. And if you remember, the Sikhs were the biggest contributors to the First World War. They came and fought. And so for them, this was like the ultimate insult. So everything changed after that. The tide turned. the first signs of Indian independence sort of took root from Jallianwala Bagh.
Yeah, it's such an important book, such an important piece of social history, really, isn't it? What's next for you? We met at the Fairway Gaul Literary Festival in Sri Lanka, and I know that you've been doing a lot of festivals. You're jetting around the world talking about your work.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's something that I've been tinkering with, this filing cabinet of stories that I have. It'll happen. It always takes 2-3 years. It's something historical, and it's not about the war. So I think every time I do one on the war, it's so intense that I need to do something else after that. So I did Noor Inayat Khan's, I did Spy Princess, and then I wrote Victoria and Abdul. Mm-hmm. And then I did the First World War, and now I have to write something different.
And in between all of this, I mean, of course, lots of your appearances, you're in huge demand.
Oh, it's nothing like that, but it's fun. And it's always good to meet readers, really, and get their responses. I think otherwise writing is such a lonely job. You're just sitting there in libraries or in your study. Once the book is done, it's out there. It's in the public domain, and it's lovely to just get a feel of how people have enjoyed the book.
And your journalism continues throughout?
Oh, yes. Yes, there's endless stories on Brexit. And we go on. Yes, so it does.
Shravani, thank you so much for talking to me.
You're welcome.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to the production team of George McDonough and Christy Evans. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or app, from SoundCloud, Mixcloud, or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.